Today is Thursday, October 14th, and you're listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I am Junior Dorfo, broadcasting from Washington, D.C. Coming up, U.S. explores option B in Iran nuclear talks.
Iran was the focus of talks Wednesday at the State Department between Secretary of State Antony Blinken and his counterparts from Israel and the United Arab Emirates.
Plus, Madagascar battles climate change-induced drought.
There was no more water to drink. The price of rice had gone up. We had to sell our livestock to buy food. I was very afraid to die.
Also, U.S. Food Agency moves to limit salt in American foods. Our top story today is in the Middle East. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken said time was running out for Iran to return to negotiations in Vienna to revive the 2015 Iran nuclear deal. He also said the United States was prepared to consider other options if Iran refused to negotiate in good faith. VOA's senior diplomatic correspondent Cindy Sain reports.
Iran was the focus of talks Wednesday at the State Department between Secretary of State Antony Blinken and his counterparts from Israel and the United Arab Emirates. Blinken said that for the past 9 months, the Biden administration has made clear the U.S. would return to full compliance with the Iran nuclear deal if Iran did the same. Now, he says, time is running out.
I'm not going to put a specific date on it, but with every passing day and Iran's refusal to engage in good faith, the runway gets short.
Israeli Foreign Minister Yair Lapid painted a grimmer picture, saying Iran is on the threshold of acquiring nuclear weapons.
If the Iranians don't believe the world is serious about stopping them, they'll race to the bomb. Israel reserves the right to act at any given moment in any way.
Blinken said the U.S. still believes the 2015 Iran nuclear deal is the most effective way to deal with the challenge posed by Iran. But the U.S. is prepared to consider other options if Iran refuses to negotiate. Lapid said those other options were at the core of their talks Wednesday. For months, the U.S., along with other major powers, has sought to salvage the 2015 deal, formerly known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or JCPOA, through a series of indirect talks in Vienna, Austria. But those talks have stalled, and some observers say prospects look even dimmer with the new leadership in Tehran. Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi says Iran's nuclear program is peaceful, and he has slammed U.S. sanctions on Tehran as a new way of waging war. Cindy Sain, VOA News.
Syrian government forces backed by Russia have recently ramped up attacks against Idlib, the last rebel enclave. A Turkish military force stands in the way of Syrian troops that are poised to seize Idlib, a move Ankara fears could result in millions of refugees fleeing to Turkey. For VOA, Dorian Jones reports from Istanbul.
Russian-backed Syrian regime forces are stepping up their attacks on Idlib. Syrian President Bashar al-Assad is pledging to retake the rebel-controlled enclave, home to millions of refugees. For now, Turkish armed forces in Idlib stand in the way of Assad's goal, and analysts warn they are in an increasingly precarious position. Haldun Solmaz Türk is a retired Turkish army general, now an analyst with the 21st Century Turkey Institute.
There are many risks involved. Risk of direct conflict with Syrian forces involving even Russian armed forces elements. Risk of a conflict with those so-called Idlib Emirates controlling Idlib area.
Last year, 33 Turkish soldiers were killed in Idlib in an airstrike the rebels blamed on the Syrian Air Force. Turkey's military presence in Idlib is part of a deal struck between Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan and his Russian counterpart, Vladimir Putin. But Moscow accuses Ankara of failing to honor the agreement to purge Idlib of radical jihadist groups, along with heavy weaponry. Turkey recently reinforced its military presence in Idlib. Turkey's opposition is warning any Idlib attack threatens a humanitarian disaster. One such warning came recently from Ünal Çeviköz, a member of parliament with Turkey's main opposition party, the CHP.
The civilian population feels that such an attack is coming from the Syrian army, supported by the Russian air force. The civilians will probably try to find refuge moving towards the north. And that, of course, will create a new migration wave, and it will create a serious pressure on the Turkish border. That is the main security risk that we are facing.
Turkey is already hosting nearly 5 million refugees, most of whom fled the Syrian civil war. The possibility of another wave of refugees is spurring the main opposition parties to call on Ankara to open talks with Damascus, a move Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan has ruled out. Instead, Erdogan is looking to his relationship with Putin. Analysts suggest Putin benefits from the current tensions over Idlib. Aydın Selcan is a columnist with the Duvar news portal.
After a 6 years of interlude, Bashar Assad suddenly rushed to Moscow in the middle of the night, like a month ago or so, and had a one-on-one meeting with Putin. Right after that, Erdogan went to Sochi. So in a way, Putin shows that he is the kingmaker, that he can both push Erdogan and Bashar Assad to do things in the interests of Russia and Russia only.
For that reason, some analysts predict Putin may broker another compromise over Idlib, ensuring Russia retains its leverage over both Ankara and Damascus. Dorian Jones, VOA News, Istanbul.
In Madagascar, more than a million people are suffering from a four-year drought that the World Food Programme has called the worst in 40 years. It is also at risk of seeing the world's first climate change-produced famine, according to the UN's Food and Agriculture Organization. Anne Zouakan reports from Antananarivo, Madagascar.
Water is precious and rare in southern Madagascar, where rain has not fallen in some areas for years. Farmer and father of six, Dipens Untobo lost all his crops and animals to the drought, the worst to hit the region in four decades.
There was no more water to drink. The price of rice had gone up. We had to sell our livestock to buy food. I was very afraid to die. If it wasn't for the government's help, we would have died of hunger.
Thousands of people have fled Madagascar drought-ravaged areas to look for food. As the World Food Programme warns, the risk of famine is growing. To cope, authorities built centers for health care and to teach mothers how to process cassava to feed their children.
Also, distribution of hot meals, food, and water every day. There are approximately 40,000 people, even 100,000 people per day, to whom we have been able to distribute 1 liter of water per person per day in these centers.
Green Title, a government project launched this year, gives farmers like Untobo land, seeds, and livestock to help them recover. The program also teaches Madagascar's farmers sustainable agriculture so they can be more resilient to future drought. It's an important skill for farmers on the island nation, which sees frequent drought.
Given the availability or not of water, given the characteristics of the land, how should you grow what to make things better? That's the bottom line. That's climate smart agriculture.
The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change says temperatures in southern Africa are rising at double the global rate. For farmers like Untobo, the war against drought and famine is far from over. Anne Zwanke for VOA News, Antananarivo, Madagascar.
The report marking the International Day for Disaster Risk Reduction finds many deaths and economic losses from natural disasters could be averted by investing in preventive disaster risk reduction measures. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
Climate-related disasters have nearly doubled over the past 20 years, with developing countries bearing the brunt of the disasters. Though extreme weather events and other disasters continue to grow, the UN Office for Disaster Risk Reduction says little money is being allocated to help countries prevent or reduce risks. The report finds $133 billion of official development assistance was allocated for disaster-related aid between 2010 and 2019, but only $5.5 billion was invested in measures to reduce the risks and lessen the impact of disasters. For every $100 spent on disaster-related development aid, it says only 50 cents go toward protecting development from the impact of disasters. Office for Disaster Risk Reduction Director Ricardo Mena says even that low-level ODA funding should be better targeted. He says it should be used to address the many needs of poorer, more vulnerable countries.
One would think that countries that are more prone to disasters and that experience higher mortality rates would be the ones where DRR financing would be allocated the most. But insufficient investment is being provided to prevent future disasters in areas where high mortality is likely.
Mena says failure to invest in DRR or disaster risk reduction is like buying a nice car which has no brakes.
Investing in DRR, we know it makes sense, and in terms of cost benefit, it's tremendously positive. So yes, we are saying it's better to attack the underlying factors of risk than having to spend more money at a time when disasters actually happen.
Academic studies find every dollar invested in disaster risk reduction prevention can result in savings of $3 to $15 in disaster losses. MENA is calling for an increase in ODA funding to help poor countries adapt to climate change and implement national strategies for disaster risk reduction. He cites small island states, the least developed countries, and landlocked developing countries as particularly needy. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
U.S. climate envoy John Kerry is tempering expectations for a UN climate summit sometimes billed as the make or break for the Earth's future. He acknowledged that next month's talks likely will end with nations still short of the targets of cuts in coal and petroleum emissions that are needed to stave off increasingly devastating levels of global warming. But in an interview with the Associated Press, Kerry also credited the United States, European Union, Japan, and other allies that over the past year have pledged bigger, faster cuts in fossil fuel emissions ahead of the talks in Glasgow, Scotland. The U.S. Food and Drug Administration on Wednesday gave restaurant chains and packaged food companies a goal of reducing sodium levels in Americans by an average of 12%, part of its attempt to clamp down on preventable health issues such as high blood pressure, which can lead to heart attacks and strokes. Lisa Bannerhardt of Reuters produced this report.
Fast food and takeout. It's cheap, it's easy, it's tasty. And it's often loaded with sodium, a major factor in the growing epidemic of preventable health issues. Which is why the U.S. Food and Drug Administration on Wednesday issued new guidelines calling on chain restaurants and packaged food companies to set sodium reduction targets over the next 2.5 years. The goal? To lower each American's current average daily sodium intake by roughly 12%, from 3,400 to 3,000 milligrams a day. And even that is still higher than what the government really recommends, which is 2,300 milligrams a day.
But this is a step in the right direction. It's progress.
Dr. John White is chief medical officer for WebMD.
The dangers of sodium is too much, actually, we know, impacts the kidney. So that's going to affect our blood pressure. And we have an explosion of high blood pressure, especially high blood pressure that's uncontrolled and that's undiagnosed.
Nearly half of all Americans have high blood pressure, a leading cause of heart attacks and strokes. The FDA focused on more than 160 categories of processed, packaged, and prepared foods, including cheeses, pickles, nuts, sauces, deli meats, crackers, and poultry products. In other words, stuff Americans love to eat.
Most consumers and patients will think about salt, and they'll say, well, I'll reduce the amount of salt in my diet. I won't use the salt shaker. I'm not so concerned about that. What I'm concerned about is what we're talking about here, the amount of sodium that's in food, particularly processed food, to help it with flavor and packaging and, you know, as a preservative.
Likely to be impacted are packaged food giants PepsiCo, Kraft Heinz, and Campbell's Soup, and fast food favorites like McDonald's. The FDA said the public health benefit is estimated to result in tens of thousands of fewer cases of heart disease and strokes each year, as well as billions of dollars in healthcare savings over time.
That's Lisa Bernhard of Reuters. This is the Voice of America. Police say a Danish man suspected of a bow and arrow attack on a small Norwegian town that killed five people and wounded two others is a Muslim convert who was previously flagged as having been radicalized. Police Chief Ole B. Saverud told a news conference that the motives for the attack has not yet been determined. The man is suspected of having shot at people in a number of locations in the town of Kongsberg on Wednesday evening. Four women and one man died in the attack. At least five people were killed and many more injured Thursday during a protest in Beirut by the militant group Hezbollah and its allies against the league judge probing last year's massive blast in the city's port. It is not clear who began the gunfire. While it involved snipers and rocket-propelled grenades, protesters say the judge in the case was biased. The explosions of ammonium nitrate at the port killed more than 200 people and devastated much of Beirut. You are listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I am Chinedu Ofor, broadcasting from Washington, D.C. Nigerian health authorities have banned unvaccinated government employees from work as they seek to control another surge of the coronavirus. This as several workers have shunned getting the shot despite the availability of the vaccine. The U.S. has sent a second round of 3.5 million doses of Pfizer's vaccine through COVAX to Nigeria, in addition to the first round of donation, 4 million doses of Moderna vaccine on July 28th. For more, I spoke to reporter Munachi Chooks at a vaccines facility in the city of Abuja. She says the government ultimatum is making a big difference.
People are actually turning up for the vaccine right here at this center where I am. And I could say that the turnout for the vaccination has been impressive despite the many controversies surrounding it. And when I spoke with the principal health technician right here at the Area 2 Family Health Center, Abuja, she confirmed that the turnout has been massive, especially people coming for the second batch of the vaccine, unlike the first time during the first batch of the AstraZeneca vaccine, that they've seen a massive turnout this time around.
Is this facility offering the vaccine free of charge, or are people required to make any form of payment to receive the vaccines?
The vaccine right here is free because it's a government hospital, so it's free. People come in and they get jabbed and they step out. Nothing else is required.
There are reports of vaccine hesitancy based on some misinformation about the side effects of the vaccine. Have you noticed any of that? And how is that impacting on the rate of people turning out for the vaccine?
Yeah, there's been a lot of awareness to educate people on the importance of the COVID-19 vaccine. That's in taming the pandemic right here in Nigeria. People actually are beginning to listen. That's why we're having massive turnout here in Abuja. But as well, you have people that will be in doubt. And as we call in our local college, doubting Thomases, they still do exist. People that don't believe in being vaccinated. So, but a lot is going on by the government to create awareness for more people to come out to get vaccinated.
Do you know how long this current exercise of vaccinations will last? And also, there are also complaints that people who registered online do not receive notification to come back for a second batch.
Yeah, I've heard that report too about people registered online and no one gets back to them. So, but there's been announcements on local media, radio stations, even TV, for people to go locate places, primary health care centers, hospitals, public health centers, especially here in Abuja, across the six local government areas, to get vaccinated. There are about 94 vaccination posts in hospitals, primary health care centers, public health centers in Abuja. And also there are mobile vaccination posts that have been made available also. And they've been deployed to strategic locations so people can have access to them.
What about preventive measures? Are people keeping social distance? Are people washing their hands? Are people still attending large events that could otherwise be known as super spreaders?
That's where I would tell you that we have problem with in Nigeria. People are still not adhering to the protocols. You see few people wearing face masks, and people are still attending events, parties, like COVID-19 doesn't exist. And most of these people are people that have not been vaccinated. So I think the government need to work hard to convince this set of people, create more awareness, so we won't have an upsurge of pandemic right here in Nigeria.
That's reporter Munachi Chooks speaking with me from Abuja. Two Israeli scientists have grown a group of date palms from 2,000-year-old seeds. This year, one of the trees produced a harvest of hundreds of dates that until now had been considered extinct. Linda Granstein reports from Kibbutz Keturah in Israel's Arava Desert.
In the Arava Desert of Israel, not far from the Jordanian border, a new date palm is being planted. It looks like any other date tree, but this one grew from a 2,000-year-old seed that was found at Masada, where close to 1,000 Jews committed suicide so they would not be captured by the Romans.
The seeds that are found in archaeological sites in this country, very little is done with them. They're examined, of course, but no one had ever tried to grow them. And I thought some years ago that it would be interesting to see if they could be grown. Why? Because a lot of these species that were once here 2,000 years ago, more, have disappeared. So why not try and grow them from ancient seeds?
Many thought this task was impossible, but Salon and her horticulturalist partner, Elaine Soloway, succeeded in growing a tree from what Salon says is the oldest date seed ever germinated. The first tree, Methuselah, was a male and couldn't produce dates.
A few years later, we grew another seed from the Judean desert, and this was a female, and I called her Hannah, after my mum. She grew into a beautiful female tree and started flowering, and so we took Methuselah's pollen, and we pollinated Hannah, and lo and behold, this is what we got. The first Judean dates in 2,000 years.
The dates are drier than most Israeli dates. Salon says they may have medicinal properties, having been used in ancient times to treat bowel problems, depression, and even as aphrodisiacs. Historians say the renewal of these dates can make history come alive.
It does give us a unique perspective or contact with the world of 2,000 years ago. These were seeds of actual dates that these people actually ate. Now, dates, of course, were part of the staple of the Mediterranean diet, part of the triad of dates, olive oil, and wine, all of which was found up at Masada as well. Dates were used in many dishes. We have ancient cookbooks. It was one of the main sources of sweetness, date, honey, and so forth. So this brings us closer in a very physical, tangible way to the people who lived 2,000 years ago.
This ability of the date seeds, and maybe not only date seeds, but seeds to remain dormant for so many thousands of years and then spring back to life, I think is a vitally important part of nature's ability to restore and renew itself. And I guess in an age of species decline and climate change, this is like a bright light in an otherwise very difficult period that the world is going through now.
Perhaps ancient dates can give us solutions to modern problems. For VOA News, Linda Gradstein at Kibbutz Keturah.
Taiwanese authorities say a building in southern Taiwan that blazed out of control for hours overnight has killed at least 46 people. Officials said Thursday at least 41 people were injured in the fire, which engulfed a 13-story building in the major city of Kaohsiung. The fire department described the fire, which started about 3 a.m., as, quote, extremely fierce, unquote, and said several floors had been destroyed. The death toll rose steadily during the day as rescue workers searched the combined commercial and residential building. The building's age and piles of debris complicated search and rescue efforts, local media said, quoting officials. That's it for our show today. For more in-depth and breaking news 24 hours a day, please visit voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Nadia Taha, and our managing editor, Kate Pound-Dawson, I am Chinedu Ofo in Washington. Thank you so much for listening, and have a great evening.